Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
When we look at bulk products, which by value make up 31% of the agricultural exports in the U.S., we see that bulk products are down by value 7% from last year.
That's USDA economist Bart Kenner.
A big part of that is the reduction of unit values, because we actually see by volume substantial increase. Wheat is 23% higher than last year by volume. Coarse grains, corn specifically, is 39% higher than last year by volume. But those categories, the wheat, which was up 23% by volume, was down 2% by value from this time last year. And corn, which was up 39% by volume, is only up 6% by value over this time last year from those decreased unit values.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
USDA out with their World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates on Friday. The numbers for January include the outlook for U.S. wheat, slightly larger supplies and domestic use, unchanged exports, and marginally higher ending stocks. Supplies, though, raised on higher imports, increased 5 million bushels to 130 million, all on hard red spring. Feed and residual use unchanged at 120 million bushels, but offset by class changes based on USDA's grain stocks report. Projected ending stocks raised 3 million bushels to 798 million. That's up 15% from last year. Season average farm price reduced a nickel per bushel, now $5.55 on prices reported to date, and expectations for futures and cash prices for the remainder of the marketing year. The corn outlook is for lower production, feed and residual use, exports and ending stocks. Corn production estimated at 14.9 billion bushels, down 276 million as a 3.8 bushel per acre cut in yield, now to 179.3 bushels, is partially offset by a 0.2 million acre increase in harvested area. Total corn use down 75 million bushels to 15.1 billion. So the price now, season average corn price received by producers, it has been raised 15 cents to 425 per bushel. Now to soybeans, production estimated at 4.4 billion bushels, down 95 million, led by decreases for Indiana, Kansas, South Dakota, Illinois, Iowa, and Ohio. Harvested area estimated at 86.1 million acres. That's down 0.2 million. Yield estimated 50.7 bushels per acre. That's down one bushel. So with lower production, slightly higher imports, and unchanged exports and crush, soybean ending stocks projected at 380 million bushels, down 90 million. Season average soybean price projected 10.20 per bushel, unchanged from last month. Soy meal price increased $10, 3.10 per short ton. Soy oil price forecast unchanged at 43 cents per pound. And finally, to cotton. U.S. balance sheet production and ending stocks all increased while exports have been reduced. Domestic use and beginning stocks are unchanged, and the all-cotton production revised upward 159,000 bales, now 14.4 million, as the national all-cotton yield estimate is increased 44 pounds to 836 pounds per harvested acre. That reflects a larger crop on lower harvested area. Most of the reduction in the harvested acreage occurring in the Southwest, while yields in numerous Southeast, Delta, and Southwest states are expected to be higher. Projected exports lower 300,000 bales to 11 million. So ending stocks, 4.8 million bales for a stocks-to-use ratio of about 38%. The 24-25 season average upland farm price is reduced to 65 cents per pound. The latest from USDA's World Ag Supply Demand Estimates, or WASD, report. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We actually try to be about 10 years out with our locations.
Kristen Torres is Executive Director of Meetings and Events with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. She's talking about CattleCon 25 this year in San Antonio.
So we have a very specific window time frame that we like to have the convention in, and we have some specific parameters around that. So it's really a big puzzle, quite honestly. We're looking at things when we go to a city, whether or not they have enough hotel rooms for us, and that the hotel rooms are in a good proximity to the convention center. Can the convention center hold us? Is the city safe? Do they have good airlift, proximity to cattle producers, you know, easy for folks to drive in if they want to come in just for a day? So all of those things play a role in a city's selection. And then to get the dates that we want, you know, we're competing with all the other associations out there that are booking space as well. And cities that are popular like San Antonio, but especially like Nashville, where we're going next year, we have to book a decade out. So we're actually a little bit behind in our scheduling right now. We're booked through 2030 currently. So we have requests for proposals out right now for all the way up through 2035, believe it or not.
Once known as the Cattle Industry Convention and NCBA Trade Show, simply known today as CattleCon.
CattleCon is the oldest and largest national convention for anyone that's in the beef cattle industry. So the very first convention for beef cattle industry was actually back in 1898. So we've been around for a really long time. But again, this is the oldest, largest show out there. So it's for anyone that's in the beef cattle industry. So it's not just for the big guys. Sometimes we maybe hear that people say, oh, that event's not for me. It truly is. So there's a lot of things that are happening at this event, and we have something for everyone there. So this is where policy is set for the industry. So business is happening there. There's committee meetings, our executive committee meets, the board of directors meets, and they're making decisions again for the industry there. Outside of that, we have a whole education program. So we have a program called Cattlemen's College, and they have over 20 breakout sessions, a general session there. We also have, outside of that, education sessions that are happening on the trade show floor. We have two areas called, one's called Cattle Chats and the other's called Learning Lounge. And so those are sessions happening all day, every day on the show floor. And then we also build an arena there on the show floor where we're doing stockmanship and stewardship sessions. And we bring in cattle for that, and we have live cattle handling sessions. So we really, truly try to tailor this to producers. Then outside of that, there's a trade show. We have over 8 acres, almost 9 acres of exhibit space filled with anything that producers need to run their operations. All the products and services from companies like John Deere, Purina, and, you know, we have a whole retail area. There's a shopping area. So there's some lifestyle things that are available there as well.
Learn more online, convention.ncba.org. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
CBO and then my joint economic economists actually worked through some math and saying, what would happen, because we have all these expiring provisions of TCJA, the 2017 tax reform.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert on the floor of the House of Representatives.
And if you extend them all, so the individuals, the pass-throughs, the small business, the subchapter S's, the partnerships, if you extend those tax provisions over 10 years, it's about $4.6 trillion of revenue that would have come in because of the increased taxes, because of the expired provisions. What is this body able to do to find policies to offset that spending? Well, it turns out CBO, and as I know this chart's a little hard to read, but the punchline on it is if you functionally extend the tax policy, but you pay for it through the decade, you actually get more economic growth. that the economy actually grows. And people go, "What? But you reached in and pulled money out to pay for the offsets." The idea is, by doing that, you didn't deficit finance it, where you're paying interest, where you're making the debt markets more fragile, and you're also pulling $4.6 trillion additional capital out of the debt markets that could have gone into you buying a new car or the business buying new plant and equipment. This is hard, because around here talking about we're going to modernize how we deliver healthcare, we're going to modernize public agencies, we're going to reduce spending by doing it better, faster, and cheaper. There's an army of lobbyists outside the hallway here who are paid to protect their current business models. How many folks do we meet from the agencies and the public employee unions that get all upset, particularly at me, when I'm doing these presentations of, here, we could use technology, we can use AI, these other things to reduce the size and cost and make government much more responsive. And then they send nasty letters and those things into your district and complain about you. But we don't have a choice. So let's walk through. So the facts are on our side. Those folks that run around here and say, we need to extend tax policy, we need to protect the border, we need to actually do all these things. But you can't create an additional fiscal rat hole and expect you're going to throw this back onto the world debt markets. My reason I want you to think about this, I'm going to show you a couple charts in a little while that where interest rates were on U.S. sovereigns way back when. Let's go back to like December. So a few weeks ago. Yesterday, the 20-year U.S. bond actually crossed over 5% for a while. If 5%, and understand, anyone with gray hair, you understand 5% is actually lower than the historical average of the previous, you know, few decades. If we were just to go to 5%, you're going to see that's almost just shy of an additional $9 trillion in debt. Double of everything we're talking about doing in reconciliation. So just doing this and communicating to the debt markets that we're serious about what's going on, because the uncomfortable truth, and I'm going to show it again, and it seems to hurt people's feelings, almost 100% of the debt for the next 10 years is interest and Medicare. We got older. Baby boomers are moving into their earned benefits. We didn't have enough children to backfill. Starting in 1990, fertility rates started to roll over. Healthcare got much more expensive. And we're almost terrified to basically say almost every dime of debt from today through the next 30 years is interest and demographics.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Planted acreage is down 0.2% from our previous forecast and down 4.3% from last year. Harvested acres are up slightly from our last forecast, but down 4.2% compared to 2023.
Patrick Boyle is chief of USDA's crops branch with the National Ag Statistics Service. On Friday with the annual crop production report for corn.
Moving over to yield. Although the final yield is down 2.1% or 3.8 bushels from the November forecast, it is still a record high, and it's up 1.1% or 2 bushels from last year. As a result, you can see total production at just under 14.9 billion bushels. That's down compared to both November and last year. As you can see, even though we are at a record high, 179.3, we are slightly below trend. We did have a number of record high yields this year, including in our top two corn producing states of Iowa and Illinois. As I mentioned a moment ago, production is forecast at 14.9 billion bushels, and that marks the fourth highest level on record. As you can see, while the expectations were lower for a final production number, today's estimate appears to be lower than what most were expecting.
And for soybeans?
Planted and harvested acres are down compared to the November forecast, but up from last year. Yield at 50.7 bushels per acre is down 1.9% or 1 bushel from last month's forecast. Soybean yields are up 0.2% or 1/10 of a bushel compared to last year. As a result, total production is forecast at 4.37 billion bushels. This is down 2.1% from the previous forecast, but up 4.9% from 2023. And like corn, it's the fourth highest production level on record. Despite being the fourth highest yield on record, we are slightly below trend line. We had three states with record high yields in 2024, Arkansas, Georgia, and Mississippi. Next, a quick look at the 2024 total production and how it compares to recent years. As I mentioned earlier, 4.37 billion bushels is the fourth highest level on record and a 4.9% increase over last year. As was the case with corn, you can see we did come in lower than what most were expecting.
Finally, Boyle looks at numbers for cotton.
We'll take a look at cotton acreage and production. Planted acreage up slightly from last forecast and 9.3% or 952,000 acres from last season. Harvested acreage down 4.2% from December, but up 28.4% or a little more than 1.8 million acres from 2023. Moving over to yield. Yield is estimated at 836 pounds per acre, up 5.6% from last month, but down 7% compared to last year. As a result, total production at 14.4 million bales is up 1.1% from the previous forecast and 19.5% or 2.35 million bales compared to 2023. Again, like we had for corn and soybeans, this chart shows how today's cotton yield ranks historically. 836 pounds per acre is the second lowest yield since 2015, and obviously well below the historic trend line. And here's a yield comparison by state for cotton. A lot of red on this map indicating year-over-year declines, including in the top two cotton-producing states, which are Texas and Georgia. We did, however, see increased yields in a number of states and record yields in Arkansas and Missouri. Next, a quick look at total production, how it compares to recent years. As I mentioned earlier, today's estimate at 14.4 million bales is up 19.5% compared to last year. In our last cotton production slide, the industry expectations, you can see that we only had a relatively minor change from last month, but we are at the top end of the industry expectations for cotton production.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
This is something that has been proposed by the new administration that's coming in, and it could have some effects on agriculture and on the overall economy, and it's in response to some of the things that other countries have been doing as well.
Rich Llewellyn is a Kansas State Extension Assistant. Talks about import tariffs.
Import tariffs basically they're a tax on goods or coming into the country, and so they raise the price of goods that are coming in. The purpose in many cases is to raise revenue for the government, but also to help with domestic industries and to protect them from competition from abroad. Now, in the case of agriculture, import tariffs on goods coming in, there's not a lot of agriculture products that will probably be taxed like that, but the effect for agriculture could be what other countries do in response to something like that. And so it would raise the price of our agricultural products in other countries, perhaps, if they respond and increase tariffs. In fact, a lot of agricultural products that we send abroad already are taxed in those countries, and it could make that even higher, making it more difficult for agricultural exports. What it does domestically is it raises the price of those goods in the country. And so for goods coming into the United States, if there are import tariffs, consumers here would pay more for them. And we would have the local industries being able to better compete, perhaps, but at a higher price and a higher cost to consumers.
What are some real-world examples? Dr. Dan O'Brien, Kansas State grain economist, explains.
Argentina has in order to raise governmental revenues, again, one of the main commodities that Argentina produces would be agricultural commodities, soybeans. So they have export taxes on soybeans, but not on soybean meal. So those taxes in the country kind of distort whether the raw beans are sold or the processed products are sold from beans. There are export subsidies that some countries have, a special incentive such as cash payments, tax exemptions, preferential exchange rates, etc., for different goods that company is trying to export. And in China, there was an export subsidy for used cooking oil that just came off. And this is, of course, U.S. soybeans oil producers, you'll look at that as a government subsidy for a product that directly competes with them.
Llewellyn explains export licenses.
Well, and some of those licenses are used regarding environmental issues or regarding food safety issues. GMOs in Europe have been subject to some of those things. So there's been a variety of policies that affect trade and then affect the producers and consumers of those commodities, both in the country receiving them as well as the country sending them out.
And that brings up phytosanitary regulations, and O'Brien explains.
Phytosanitary regulations can be kind of subtle trade barriers. They say, well, I don't like the GMOs that you have over here, or I don't like the exposure to a certain disease over there. Well, it could be a subtle, quasi-sneaky way to limit import competition from another, to protect your own industry. So there are, I guess, when you get looking at trade, it's a hardball situation where a lot of countries are seeking to protect their own industries.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
These are not meant to be snarky. They're basically a thought experiment of what you hear members walk behind these microphones saying things that, great, they're wonderful, maybe we should do them. But they have tiny effects on the survival of this republic.
How close is our country to financial catastrophe? Big ideas don't always equal big results. Representative David Schweikert from Arizona.
So let's actually walk through, just explain what I'm talking about. Okay, let's walk through the impact of borrowing. We're using this fiscal year, what we've been borrowing per day, per hour, per minute, per second. But we're going to walk through, and I'm using the clock face, and these are 12-hour clocks. So you got to picture two clock faces, trying to make some way where you make things with lots of zeros understandable. So let's actually, and this is one of my favorite ones. So back in December, we did send out some things, and we got members of our community to throw back ideas. And one of the favorite ones was, get rid of congressional salaries. Okay. In my heart of heart, I actually think we're overpaid for the quality of our work product. So maybe that's what we should do. But you get rid of every congressional salary. That Senate here, just get rid of all of it. It's actually about, over a fiscal year, it's about $1.9 billion. It's a lot of money. Okay? For an entire year's borrowing, for the entire year, it would cover 6.4 hours. Yay! We made a big impact. We covered 6.4 hours of an entire year's worth of borrowing. Okay, so that's sort of silly, but that's one of the key responses we got. I think, actually, may say more about what they think about me. All right, so let's actually do another one that came back to us from our constituent surveys. Emergency services for undocumented migrants. This is basically Obamacare subsidies, healthcare spending for those who are here undocumented. They're illegal. Now, most of this turns out, we believe, to be Obamacare subsidies. You will hear member after member after member, and people on television, the talking hosts, you'll hear it on conservative talk radio. If we just didn't spend money. Okay. So we actually did this thing called research, where we actually looked up the actual facts and the math. And it's about $2.7 billion for the entire year. So we get rid of it, and we probably should, but it's 9 hours of borrowing for an entire year. Yet how many times will you hear people say this in front of microphones? Stopping healthcare subsidies for those who are here undocumented, here illegally, is 9 hours of borrowing for an entire year. And there's our problem. We have people doing theater over honest math. So let's do another one. One of my particular favorites. Let's get rid of the Department of Education. And actually, I'm a big fan because there's, you know, if you believe in the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, why is this here at the federal government? Yes, but a big portion of their 4,500 employees is actually debt management, but that can be actually done by, you know, other agencies we have that actually have high skill folks to manage receivables, those things, bank. But if you got rid of all those 4,500 employees at the Department of Education, great! Turns out to be about $2.75 billion over an entire year. You just covered, functionally, 9 hours of borrowing. Now, how many people have you heard come behind these microphones or on conservative talk radio or other things that are saying, we're going to get rid of the Department of Education. Great! And then the conversation moves on to something else because they act like they've covered the debt. There's this lack of understanding. We're borrowing about $70,000 a second.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The latest announcement of clean energy investments from USDA's Rural Development Mission Area.
$180 million for 586 projects in 42 states across the nation and Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands.
Rural Business Cooperative Service Administrator Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan says investments originate from two programs, REAP and HBIP.
The Rural Energy for America program, it's for renewable energy systems, it's for energy efficiency upgrades, and then the Higher Blend Infrastructure Incentive Program, think about your local gas station, and it's the type of infrastructure that they can use to build out new storage tanks, build out new fuel pumps, to increase the use of biofuels.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.